Next case is People, State of Colorado versus David Kenneth Simon, case number 09SC665. Both parties ready? Argument is for 15 minutes per side, and please state your name, keep track of your time at the beginning of the argument. May proceed.
Good morning again. My name is Kathy Gillespie, and I'm here this morning representing the people of the state of Colorado. I want to start in the Simon case by talking about what I think are some major problems with the analysis of the two judges the judge who wrote the opinion and the judge that concurred with him. Obviously, as we've already discussed, his assumption that this was a substantive crime of continuing conduct, because it said in the definitional section that a pattern of sexual abuse includes two or more instances of sexual contact. The case law that the court uses in its analysis to rely on out of both New Hampshire and the state of New York, Judge Conley uses that to support his analysis that it's a substantive crime, but I think what he didn't do was take another step back and look at what the crimes were and how pattern was defined in those particular states. And in New Hampshire, I think it's called a aggravated felonious sexual assault, which says a person commits that crime when the defendant engages in a pattern of sexual abuse against another person, committing two or more acts of sexual assault between the time frame of 2 months and 5 years. So I think the language clearly in New Hampshire is that their legislature made the pattern, the act of a pattern of sexual abuse, a substantive crime. However, in New Hampshire, they did say that you could have multiple patterns between a defendant and a victim if it was based on a different type of sexual contact. And that kind of goes a little bit back to Wohlhoff, makes that distinction between basing your acts on a type of sexual conduct, whether it's, I think in that case, oral sex, digital penetration, fondling, and not being able to distinguish those between particular dates, and how we do our statute here, which is that we do have to specify the particular dates or the acts themselves within a date range. The state of New York as well, Judge Conley relied on that jurisdiction, and in their statute it actually uses the words that this the pattern crime is a continuing crime, and you are guilty of it when over a period of years you do X, Y, and Z. So I think that the cases that he relies on for his position that it's a substantive crime are irrelevant and incorrect for the purposes that he cited them for. He also goes into the allowable unit of a prosecution in a pattern crime. But again, if pattern is an enhancer, you're not really looking at the unit of prosecution in the enhancer itself. The unit of prosecution, as this court said in Wohlhoff and Quintano, is in the SAOC charge, and whether or not the DA or the victim is able to factually distinguish between separate acts, whether it's by time or movement or a new volitional impulse from the defendant. In addition, the court goes into, in kind of a convoluted way, trying to get, saying that enhancers don't equal elements anymore after Apprendi in any constitutional sense. I think all of that was argued in detail in the Lewis case, but I think that this court is aware that there are no courts, with the exception of maybe a trial court out of Kentucky, that have extended Apprendi to the double jeopardy context. And in this particular case, it's a little different than Tillery. It was an older boy, and there were multiple acts of sexual assault over a two-year period. And I think it's important for the court to think about the fact that even with older children, it can be an they may have an inability to differentiate between the acts. When it is ongoing weekly over a period of years, it may be very difficult for them to go back and say the first time, the second time, the third time, the fourth time, and give kind of any factual circumstances. And in this case, in Simon, they did what this court told them to do in Thomas, which is if you're not going to elect the acts, then give a modified unanimity instruction so that the jury is aware that they have to have a separate act supporting each act within the pattern, and that they can't rely on any duplicate acts.
Did the jury instructions in Simon look like the jury instructions, not the jury instructions, but the verdict forms in Simon look like the ones in Tillery where they had the specific charge, which was pretty well delineated right there in the jury verdict form, and then the enhancer or whatever we're going to choose to call it?
They did do the elements of, they did the crime as sexual assault on a child, and then the interrogatory took care of the question of the pattern. I don't believe that they delineated the act on the verdict form. I think that was taken care of by the Thomas instruction. I could be wrong on that, but that's my recollection of how they did it. But I think it's pretty uniform now in the trial courts that the verdict forms are done with the find an act, whether it's delineated or not, under the unanimity instruction, and then the pattern is usually done in an interrogatory form. The continuing crime, I just want to point the court to its language in Roberts, saying that the legislature, if it's going to define a crime as a continuous crime, that it needs to unmistakably communicate that in the language like it did in the Roberts theft statute. And I think that I've argued already that it's clearly a sentence enhancer. And I think Judge Conley got it wrong based on a misinterpretation of some out-of-state case law. And if the court doesn't have any more questions.
I actually do. I'm sorry. Do you think that Judge Conley took the position that you could only sentence for the pattern and not for any individual act of sexual assault on a child? Because he seems to be saying that you could sentence for the pattern and then you could have a consecutive sentence for the prostitution, but nothing else. Or how do you read that exactly?
The way I read it was, I thought he was saying that you can read this as a substantive crime and it's going to do the purpose that the legislature supposedly intended it for it to do. And the DA is still going to have the option in a differentiated case to charge every F4. But I think what he did in this case was he took the enhancer off of all of the convictions except for one. And I think that, and I said to the court earlier that there would be a double jeopardy issue. Obviously, if the legislature wanted it to be done that way, they could. But I think the way the statute's written, as an enhancer, I don't think you can do it both ways. I think you can have, the pattern has to attach to a predicate crime because it's a sentence enhancer. So I think his...
So are you saying then that you think there's a predicate crime and an enhancer?
In the Simon case? In the fact that he kept the pattern enhancer attached to, yes. And I think
that... And he vacated all the rest of the sexual assault counts, right? So what Justice Rice is saying that he was taking the much broader position.
Yes, he was.
But let me ask you this. And your theory is, assuming, I know you don't agree with this, but if if he were right about the unit of prosecution, and that's a correct application of double jeopardy, right?
If
Judge Conley was correct, I know that's not your position. If it's a continuing course of conduct, then his sentencing resolution would be correct. At least that's how I took your argument.
Most likely. I mean, I haven't interpreted the statute looking at whether or not you could, you know.
Find an intent, okay.
Well, you could use Karen Steinhauser's language and say, probably not.
If only they knew what their language got, trouble they got us into.
What do you think about the whole double jeopardy problem that's sort of lurking in the background here? I think Justice Marquez has that as well. You're neither Tillery or Simon.
I don't think that in order to get to I mean, for double jeopardy, you either have to, you know, the first one is two trials for the same conduct. We clearly don't have that here. So it goes down to whether we have multiple punishments for the same crime. And the only way you can get to multiple punishments for the same crime here is to find a continuing course of conduct. Well, if you find continuing course of conduct, then you're not, you can't believe that the F3 is an enhancer. So I don't know that Apprendi really connects in the broad statement that the defense has been arguing that, you know, Apprendi gets rid of the distinction between enhancers and elements for all purposes really isn't relevant here, because if it's a continuing course of conduct, there is no enhancer under that theory, not necessarily under Apprendi's logic in the jury trial situation. So it's a very, in order for him to get to the statement that he makes that Apprendi does apply in a double jeopardy situation, that we can't call this an enhancer to get out of the argument. One, I think, is wrong, and two, I have a very hard time following the logic that gets us to meeting that particular statement. I think if it's a continuing course of conduct, there is no enhancer, and so relying on the Apprendi language wouldn't be necessary at that point. Does the court have any other questions for me? I'll save my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Karen Taylor, and I represent the respondent in this matter, Mr. Simon. The court has already asked a lot of questions and covered a lot of ground that I would have covered if I were doing this argument for the first time in front of you. So I guess I'm just going to maybe just approach it by going back over some of the things that have been asked, and please ask me questions maybe about some of the specifics of Mr. Simon's case, too, that might be different from Mr. Tillery's.
I'll start.
Okay, great.
Do you read, how do you read Judge Conley's opinion about double jeopardy?
You mean, do I agree with the analysis? Which,
well, first of all, how do you read it, and then whether you and why you agree, if you agree with it, which I assume you do, why?
Well, I agree with him that what has been established here is a crime that is a pattern crime that shows a continuing course of conduct. And if that's the case, that is the unit of prosecution for this particular type of sexual assault on a child by one in a position of trust. And, you know, that sort of informs all of these different, I mean, to me, this area of law, these areas of law are very confusing because we have unit of prosecution and double jeopardy and legislative intent and plain language of the statute. But I think all roads sort of lead back to what did the legislature intend to do? And we look at that by looking at the language of the statute. We can look at that by looking at what was discussed when the provisions were enacted by the legislature. So to the extent that he's looking at that and saying, well, this is a continuing course of conduct, and that's how the legislature considered this offense. And in light of that, if you take that one continuing course of conduct, and in the case of one case with one victim and one time period, and you parse that out pattern after pattern after pattern after pattern, that's a double jeopardy problem. And I agree with him. I think that's correct. And I also agree with him that it's very clear that that is not what the legislature intended when it enacted this.
How far do you go into the complexity? And, you know, what is ambiguity seems to be ambiguous, obviously, right? The more complicated these schemes get. So would you go all the way into the hearing record? Would you stop somewhere short of that, or are you relying on plain language?
Well, I would find it odd for this court not to consider that for a few different reasons. One is you already have. That's what happened in Longoria. Justice Bollock delved into the hearings to decide what the plain language of the statute meant in that context. So I think it would be odd for that to have happened already from this court, and then all of a sudden, all these years later, the court to say, no, we don't need to look at that again. So that's already happened. So does that answer your...
You'd find this ambiguous, and you'd go the whole distance and see what they did through various amendments and what they did in the hearings and...
I lost my train of thought there. I don't actually think, I can see the argument that it's ambiguous. I don't think it's ambiguous.
Okay, that's what I'm asking you.
Yeah, and why do I think that? Because, first of all, they use the word pattern. It's a pattern of conduct here. Pattern, just as a word in its commonly understood meaning, is a course of conduct. It's many things happening. So I think your first clue is just to use what it's called. It's called a pattern. And if you're unclear about what that meant, then I think the definition makes it very clear. A pattern is two or more. And the or more is relevant here because there's no ceiling on it, Your Honor. I know that you've asked, this is a serious offense. Doesn't the legislature want to have a policy about punishing this more seriously? And they reflected that in the statutory language of two or more. There's no limit on that. 2, 20, 200, or as they discussed in the hearings, 300. So I think those are some of the clues that on its face, this is what Judge Connolly said it is, which is a crime that's a continuing course of conduct.
And if I could step in at that point, at this juncture, how much of your analysis is dependent upon the Court of Appeals' reliance on Apprendi? And the reason I ask that is, as I mentioned in the last argument, this court has long held that the pattern aspect is a sentence enhancer. And Judge Connolly seems to get around that by saying, well, actually, in light of Apprendi, we can no longer consider it a sentence enhancer. It's functionally an element of a new crime pattern offense. And therefore, we can sort of analyze it under double jeopardy principles. If we disagree with that, if we disagree that the analysis of Apprendi automatically is imported into a double jeopardy context, do you still win, and how do you get there?
Well, because again, all those lead to what the legislature intended, and the legislature enacted, I guess, even if it had no relevance for, we could say, well, we're not going to get into the sentence enhancement debate here because this is double jeopardy and not the Sixth Amendment right to jury trial. Well, obviously, it still matters for the Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial. So I think the court has to be careful about repeating sentence enhancement language post-Blakely when we know it does have, you know, the distinctions that it used to hold don't exist anymore. So a lot of those older cases were back in the day when that mattered for Sixth Amendment purposes as well. So it's not like you're not going to be retreating from that. You are, for sure, in the Sixth Amendment context. And maybe there's an open question about what is going to happen in a Fifth Amendment context. But as Justice Scalia says in Sadezan, what's the principal distinction constitutionally for making that a difference? So there's that aspect of the debate. But you can resolve this, I think, looking at the plain language, just under basic principles. All these are principles of statutory construction, looking at the plain language of the statute.
To me, all of this boils down to whether you view the pattern aspect as an enhancer or as part of a newly defined offense. And the way Judge Connolly seems to get there is through this Apprendi analysis. We lump it in, and now it's defined as a new offense. And my concern is, if we disagree with that, what's the argument for still calling it a continuing course of conduct?
I think just the plain language of the statute and looking at what the legislature intended when it enacted it. What they intended, and you know, there was some suggestion in the early argument, well, there was a title here that they called it an enhancement in the title, and maybe some suggestion from Justice Martinez that the questions with Ms. Steinhauser and the 300 question wasn't as clear, perhaps, about what they intended. But I think it's very clear that when the bill's sponsor stands up in front of the House of Representatives and says, the Supreme Court held that a date and time of the offense is a necessary element of proving the offense, what this bill does is to establish the crime of a sexual pattern of assault or abuse, which eliminates that specific requirement, I think that's clear. I mean, it's crystal clear. And this court actually has the luxury of not having to struggle very much with what the legislature intended. I think in these legislative intent, just statutory construction cases generally, a lot of times there's not a lot there in the record. I think one of the U.S. Supreme Court cases, I can't remember if it's Whalen or Albernaz, one of the majority was talking about how the record's just silent on what this means, and we just can't take anything from that. You have the luxury of having it be very clear what was intended here. So I think those principles exist apart from a double jeopardy analysis.
But as you probably heard in the last argument, there seems to be some tension between those comments and the language that was ultimately produced at the end of the day. And given our sort of approach to statutory construction, how do we get there?
By reading it consistent with that. That has been suggested there's a tension there, but I actually think it makes a lot of sense. In the world that existed in 1989, where the prosecutors believed they could not prosecute these crimes at all. So the question of multiple enhanced, individualized sexual assault convictions was clearly not on the table, clearly not part of what they intended, because the whole point of it was they couldn't prove any at all. And that's what they wanted to address.
But what's your view on the either-or colloquy we had here about if they actually prove the individual incidents? Is there a choice of either-or, or can you do both? Can you have the enhanced pattern on one, and you have the sexual assaults on the rest of them that were found by the jury?
Well, I think there's a lot of overlap, I think, between the argument yesterday about the difference between what might be allowed constitutionally, what might be allowed by the intent of the legislature, and what the prosecution's discretion in charging could be. I think if you were honoring the legislative intent as it was at the time, it was clear that if you could charge the individualized counts, then you'd do that, and nothing prevented that. And the seriousness of the offense would be reflected in the fact that if you could differentiate 300 different sexual assaults, so be it. And the defendant, if you can prove them, he would be convicted, and he would face sentencing on 300 counts. But they were concerned with the fact that they couldn't do it at all. So at that time, it wasn't either or. And I think Ms. Eggleston talked a little bit about that, about the statutory language that suggests if it's this one, is an F4. If it's this pattern, which is two or more, it's an F3. And it may seem, I mean, we have come so far since 1989, it may seem strange, Justice Hobbs, that the legislature thought it was enough, reflecting the seriousness of repeated acts, to go from a 4 to a 3 and to make it a crime of violence, but clearly they did. That discussion was had, that in the 300 question, that no, probably you couldn't have 300, but the seriousness of it would be reflected in the fact that it's an F3 and it's a crime of violence. So to the extent that they were effectuating a policy of treating these more seriously, that was what they thought they were doing at that time.
Given that the prosecutor has a choice, and in this case and in Tillery, prosecutor did charge both, we'll say individual acts and then pattern, if we were to adopt your analysis, what happens at the end of the day? Do all of those F3s become F4s, or is it all consolidated into a single F3 conviction?
Well, in this particular case, there was never an F4 charged. Every single count was a pattern count, charged as pattern of abuse, F3. So there was no charge at any point in the information regarding the sexual assaults that was an F4 charge. Everything was an F3.
And that's actually why I was asking about the verdict forms. How were they different, if at all, from the Tillery verdict forms?
Not being as familiar with the Tillery verdict forms, I can just tell you what the Mr. Simon's verdict forms required the jury to, these 10 counts, they marked that they were finding it was committed as part of a pattern of abuse. On 9 of the 10 counts, They also answered an interrogatory. It's a Thomas-like interrogatory. They did not find...
They were not different. I'm sorry, I'm interrupting, but I think I just want to... Oh, yeah. So they weren't differentiated in any way on the verdict form?
I apologize for not directly answering that question. They were not differentiated. They all look the same. The only difference in the 10 verdict forms on pattern was that the first one didn't include the Thomas type of interrogatory.
And so
there's nothing differentiated about this act or that act.
Sure. So there were just 10 undifferentiated patterns?
Yes.
How was that instructed? What was the carrying?
Well, and I think not finishing our point, but what they found in the Thomas, the last part of the interrogatory on 9 of the 10, was they checked a box that said, we find this act is, I believe the language was, separate and distinct from any other act. Now, what that meant in a pre-Wohlhoff world, I'm not entirely sure. They also were given the option of finding that all of the acts alleged by the victim had been committed. They did not find that. This was not a case where the jury found beyond a reasonable doubt that everything alleged had been found. So as I stand here today...
Well, how did they know from the verdict forms which one was not proven, if they were set out the way you said?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know. No one knows. I don't think you can tell from the verdict forms in Mr. Simon's case what the jury relied on for the pattern findings. Because they weren't required to say. And these on their face were the same thing over and over and over. And we know they didn't find all of them happened. That's the sum total, I believe, of what you can take from the verdict forms in this case.
Ms. Taylor?
Yes.
Almost out of time. So then our cert question is incorrect? Because we asked the enhanced issue from a class 4 to a class 3. If there's no class 4 charge, now you got me confused. I mean, not charged, convicted, jury verdict. They're all felony threes.
This is one of the cases.
Resistance of trust coupled with a pattern.
Every single one, even the first one.
Okay.
Which is why I think Judge Connolly reaches the decision that he can. There are not 10 patterns here as it was charged. There's just one. And so, for that reason, if the court has no further questions, I'd ask that the...
May I please, Chief, ask a couple more questions? There were 20 total counts.
Yes.
Half of which charged F4s, I thought.
No.
Well, okay, help me with this, please.
I think that's what we all thought.
If I may have a...
And sorry if taking you by surprise on this, but we're trying to figure out exactly.
I want to double check as well before.
Or is it simply that half charged position of trust and half
didn't? Charged and didn't, so there was the PLTs, and then there were the 10 that were not. Those were all pattern S3s?
Right.
With no differentiated conduct.
What I can say for sure is that the second 10 were sexual assault of a child, position of trust, not pattern, because they occurred prior to pattern being in the position of trust statute. So that was those were those 10. They occurred early in time. The 10 we're talking about now, post-pattern, were all charged counts 1 through 10, first count through 10, sexual assault on a child by one in a position of trust, pattern.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I would just ask that the court affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals.
One distinction, Justice Rice, to your question, is that the verdict forms did not elect an act, a specific act. They did, however, charge, the jury find the defendant guilty of sex assault on a child, position of trust, yay or nay. Then the pattern was asked as an interrogatory. So we're kind of, because the defense is calling pattern a crime, they're saying that there are 10 crimes, of sexual assault on a child pattern charge.
But there was at least a carrying instruction in the jury instructions that said you had to, each of these had to be distinct?
Correct. So it was a, it was
and a... How did we know which was which?
We don't necessarily know which 10 the jury chose, but we do know that the jury agreed on which 10 they found beyond reasonable doubt to have taken place.
Except for one, which makes it confusing. Isn't that what Ms. Taylor was just saying, though? They returned
the first one, I'm not sure what she was referring to as far as the one. They didn't find, you know, the Thomas instruction says generally that, you know, we, the jury, find the defendant committed the same act of sexual abuse, separate and distinct from any other act of sexual abuse. And then it usually has a second box that they can check that says, we, the jury, find that all of the acts occurred. And it, what I believe Ms. Taylor is referring to is that they checked that first one that said, we, the jury, find beyond a reasonable doubt that the same act occurred and that that act is separate and distinct from every other act, which satisfies...
But would you agree these two cases are different, though, because of the way the charging document reads?
No, for purposes of defining the whether or not they
can about notice, defense purposes, notice, you know.
I think the Thomas talked about how the notice and the bill of particulars, if, and I don't remember if there was one in this case, but the acts were described in the affidavit and the DA charged 10, you know, 10 acts when the child said it happened multiple times over a period of 2 years. And so factually they're different, and yes, they were charged differently, but both are correct because Thomas says you either have to give a unanimity instruction or the DA has to elect, and that's up to the trial judge under his discretion to decide which way to go. So I think at least for purposes of the argument here, there's no difference. Clearly there's a difference under Thomas, but I don't think it makes a difference to what we're discussing here.
Let me ask you this, and this is just trying to think this through. So say you only had two specific acts, distinct or delineated acts, the jury came back guilty on one and not guilty on the other, but came back guilty on pattern on both. That wouldn't make any sense, would it?
No, he wouldn't be able to have...
So what if they only came back guilty on pattern on one? You had two acts, which would have theoretically been enough for a pattern, but they came back not guilty on the other. That would have been an inconsistent verdict. You would have had to set that aside.
Correct. And I think that goes back to the...
Sure. So the only way that you can have enough to have a pattern is to have two or more counts, each of which there's a guilty verdict on.
I think you have to have, in the evidence, you have to have evidence of two or more acts. I don't think it has to be a charged act.
You don't think you have to have counts? You think you only have to have, so you could have one pattern, one count alleging a pattern, and then the evidence could show a number of acts, X number of acts more than one.
Correct. And then if the DA elected for the one charged act, the jury would be obviously agreeing that that particular act happened beyond a reasonable doubt based on the, you know, intercourse in the garage.
Sure, and sure. But at least
you would then have to find an interrogatory to that act that said, we, the jury, find and agree that at least one more act occurred within the time frame charged. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay.
Thank you.
So just to wrap up, I think in order to get where Judge Conley and the defense wants this court to go, you would have to get through quite a few hoops. You would have to get over the plain language of the statute. You would have to find that pattern is a substantive crime, an ongoing crime, and not just a sentence enhancer. I think what we have here is the solution that the legislature wanted, which was the pattern of sexual assault, and it takes care of both situations, undifferentiated and differentiated. If the court doesn't have any further questions, it's all.
Thank you. Thank both attorneys for their arguments. Case will be submitted on the briefs.